Welcome to Wiki Politiki, a show designed to bring right and left front and center, to turn the funk into function, and leave the junk at the junction. At a time when so much political discourse is heat without light, Wiki Politiki shines the light of love and truth on the darkened corridors of power, and then brings leading solutionaries into conversation to light the way forward together. Your host is Steve Behrman, author, comedian, and political and spiritual uncommentator. You might know Steve as his cosmic comic alter ego, Swami Beyond Ananda, or as the author of a more serious book with cellular biologist Bruce Lipton, Spontaneous Evolution. If you recognize that crisis precipitates evolution, and judging by the current crises, the chances of precipitation are 100%, this show is for you. Welcome to the Evolutionary Upwising. Now, here is your host, Steve Behrman.
Well, hi there. Welcome to Wiki Politiki, Conversations for Co-Creation, where we shed light on the darkened corridors of power, and we shine a light ahead of us to the path where evolution is leading. The purpose of Wiki Politiki is to bring left and right front and center, to face the music and dance together, to address problems rather than defend positions. Well, Swami Beyond Ananda has told us that the greatest threat to the planetary ecosystem is the human ecosystem. Well, you know, there's nothing wrong with the human ego. Who would we be without an ego? Nobody, that's who. But what if, in addition to being somebody, we're also everybody? What if we were connected in ways that seem outlandish to the ordinary mind? What if, in fact, there was no such thing as the ordinary mind, and that we're all part of one big extraordinary mind? Our guest this week is Dr. Larry Dossey, who has been long recognized as an influential advocate of the role of the mind in health and the role of spirituality in healthcare. He's written books that offer both empirical and anecdotal evidence of the healing power of prayer, and his latest book offers the best antidote yet to this unbalanced individualism that has woven us dangerously outside the web of life. Dr. Dossey is a graduate of University of Texas and Southwestern Medical School in Dallas. He served as a battalion surgeon in Vietnam and was chief of staff of Medical City Dallas Hospital. In his 1989 book, Recovering the Concept of the Non-Local Mind, not confined to the brain or the body, the mind that spread infinitely throughout time and space. Well, since then, the concept non-local mind has been adopted by many leading scientists, and it's part of an emerging image of who we really are. Larry Dossey is also the author of Healing Words, The Power of Prayer and the Practice of Medicine, as well as Prayer is Good Medicine, How to Reap the Healing Benefits of Prayer. As I probably said, his latest book is called One Mind, How Our Individual Mind is Part of a Greater Consciousness and Why It Matters. So, welcome, Larry.
Steve, it's great to be on your program. Thanks for the invitation.
Good, good. Great to have you. Okay, well, One Mind, that's a pretty big topic, so let's begin with an overview. Seems to me that this One Mind idea is part of the perennial wisdom that underlies, or maybe a better term is under truths every religious and spiritual system. And in the course of our lifetimes, it seems that science is now affirming these truths. So tell us what the One Mind concept is all about and what we call New Edge science has to say about it.
Well, it's an idea which I think is gaining scientific respectability and is almost inevitable for us moderns because of one overwhelming fact, and that little fact is called data. There's just an enormous body of scientific evidence that there is a collective aspect to our minds, and I suppose the first point to make about this is that this is, although this idea is dressed in modern science, it really goes back, as you've already pointed out, for millennia. It's several thousand years old, You can find this idea in Hindu philosophy and the Akashic Records idea. Plato talked about our consciousness as being unitary. And then the thing that I think makes this a different conversation is that some of the leading scientists and physicists of the 20th century have come on board in advocating this idea of a collective consciousness. I mean, there are a lot of heavy hitters we could mention among them. Erwin Schrödinger, who came out explicitly saying there's only one single mind out there. He won the Nobel Prize in Physics in 1933. There's been an unbroken chain of these incredible scientists who have affirmed the idea, to say nothing of what you've already mentioned, a series of experiments involving healing intentions and prayer, not just in people, but in other organisms such as microbes and even lower animals such as mice and so on, showing that we can combine our consciousness to operate at a distance and affect the biological features and function of someone who may not even know we're making the effort. I find this incredibly fascinating and interesting because it takes us beyond the necessity of thinking that we are all individuals cut off from everybody else, and this opens an incredible number of options about us as we go forward in trying to survive and thrive on this particular planet.
You know, we're going to talk a lot more about how your ideas, how these new ideas that are emerging, first of all, the kind of resistance they're receiving, and then, of course, the kind of acceptance that they're receiving. But, of course, I'm always curious as to how people develop their find their calling and so on. So you were a battalion surgeon in Vietnam. You're chief of staff at a major medical center. What made you curious about this more invisible dimension of medicine, and what sparked your attention, and how did that unfold?
Well, I guess the first step in the process was when I was about 18 years old, I stumbled quite by accident upon a little paperback book of essays by Ralph Waldo Emerson. And he talked about something I'd never even heard of before. He called it the oversoul. And this was basically the idea of the one mind, a collective, unitary, unifying notion of consciousness. I just put that on the back burner. And then when I went off to college, I began to encounter influences that said that this was all nonsense. My experience in college was that of a almost totally materialistic notion toward consciousness, that it's produced by the brain, it does not survive the death of the brain and body, and everything else is nonsense. When I got to medical school, after 4 years of materialistic indoctrination in college, things began to open up in a different way. I began to encounter the writings of Carl Jung and his notion of the collective unconscious. I began to read widely in the mystical literature of the East, in which this idea has long found a home. And then I began to devour the works of modern physicists, Schrödinger, Bohm, Heisenberg, and so on, which talked about a collective, single, underlying unity that is the underpinnings of our individual experience of consciousness. When I began to practice medicine, Steve, I had a series of experiences which just drove this home in a way I couldn't deny. I began to have personal dreams.
Okay.
Which we can talk about after the break.
Yeah. Am I on?
Hello? Yes.
Okay, good. Yeah, we got disconnected on the other line, so I'm glad. What's really interesting is, and I kind of missed that because I dropped off, as you read, was it the work of what else in regards to the work of Jung that, and other people that got you re-engaged in this different kind of inquiry?
Yeah. Well, I began to have a series of precognitive dreams my first year in medical practice, in which I would see in astonishing detail what was going to happen in the lives of my patients at least 24 hours before they even happened.
Wow.
This blindsided me, you know, and I knew in an instant that the world didn't work the same way that I was taught about it in college. So I began to devour different areas of literature, such as the paranormal, parapsychological experiments in precognition, distant healing, and so on. And the thing that really nailed this down for me is that patients began to express to me their own strange experiences of seeing into the future, of dreaming their own diagnoses, and sometimes even dreaming the therapies for a diagnosis that I had not even made yet. This just sort of exploded for me when people began to understand that I was open to this sort of thing. Even my colleagues in medicine began to share their experiences with me. I began to think that this idea of collective unitary consciousness was one of the best kept secrets in modern medicine. So there you are. I mean, this got to be such an issue for me. I just couldn't escape it. It just piled in on every avenue of experience, and it was an awakening for me, sort of a mystical revelation, in addition to being scientific, because by that time there were studies that were being done that affirmed this point of view.
You know what you're talking about, Einstein called it spooky action at a distance. You know, these things happening remote that are not explainable by material science. And so right away from your own experience, you began to have a realization that not everything you were, you know, that essentially there was limitations to the material medicine that you were doing. How did that impact your medical practice at that point?
Well, it's interesting. First of all, let me say that I'm a board-certified internist, and I have enormous confidence and faith in physical medicine and surgery as far as it goes. But the lesson for me was that our approach in modern medicine doesn't go far enough. I'm not about to repudiate the fantastic contributions made by drugs and medication and surgery. But let me just give you one example. I gave a lecture to a group of Harvard physicians who had gathered together in a conference for a so-called update in internal medicine. And I talked about some of my ideas about collective consciousness and its role in medicine. And then we had a Q&A session, and a female internist stood up in this large group and said, "Well, I get dreams." She said, "I see numbers in my dreams." She said, "I dream these specific values of my patient's lab tests before I even order the tests." I thought that was pretty wild.
Yeah.
And then my patients began to tell me their own experiences. One woman came to my office one day and said that she saw three little white spots on her left ovary, and so she was sure that she has ovarian cancer. Well, we did a sonogram of her ovaries, and there were three little white spots, just like she had dreamt, not causing any symptoms. But she got her diagnosis wrong. These were innocuous ovarian cysts that didn't cause any trouble. They were not cancer. But how did she get that visual image, which was absolutely precise when matched against the sonogram? These sort of experiences just flooded in on me, and I thought, you know, I think I'll do a book about this. And so I put the information together that patients and physicians had flooded me with and paired it up with the studies that had been done in the field at that time. And that's how the book Healing Words was published, which was really the first in-depth look at the scientific side of this business of non-local consciousness.
You know, the whole idea, in fact, Bruce Lipton and I quoted you and your work in Spontaneous Evolution and talking about these anomalous healings and also in the inexplicable, through modern science, power of prayer. Now, I think you had mentioned that early on, that that these have taken place. It's one thing, you can actually look at the placebo effect working with human beings when they think they're being given something. That in itself is kind of inexplicable. But when you begin to work with animals and bacteria and plants, and you notice that your intention impacts their physiology because they don't necessarily have a mind to influence, that's pretty mind-blowing in and of itself. So you published this book on healing words, and you know, what was the response to that?
Well, I must say that it was 90% positive from the reading American public. The book wound up being a bestseller bestseller on the New York Times list. Oprah just in it and invited me on to her program. So there was a very enthusiastic response from 90% of the reading American public. There was criticism and pushback by some of the fundamentalists. Conservative religious groups in the country, they were actually offended by a line of evidence that I drew out in the book, which said that nobody, no religion has specifically cornered the market on this healing intentions and prayer phenomenon. Studies show that it seems to work for Hindus and Buddhists as well as fundamentalist Christians. And this was just a red flag for fundamentalists all over. I began to accumulate a file drawer of nasty letters that I got from people who just thought that I had really screwed up this whole idea of prayer. But I was happy to do that. For one thing, I don't belong to a specific religious organization. I wasn't fronting for any particular religious point of view. And my claim was that this is a feature that permeates human intentions. It isn't limited to one specific religion, and unfortunately, this infuriated quite a number of people. But I also am happy to report, Steve, that it had a fantastic influence in the medical schools. When the book came out, there were only three medical schools out of about 120 in the United States that had any coursework looking at the correlations between spiritual practice and human health and longevity. And as we speak, there are around 90 of the medical schools that have adopted coursework looking at the correlations, which I laid out in the book. So I'm just happy to say that the taboo has been broken in American medical education over these ideas.
That's a really good sign. We're going to take a little break, and we'll be back in a little bit with Dr. Larry Dossey, talking more about prayer and the one mind.
Connecting you with the best of the conscious minds in the world. Om Times Radio, IOM FM. Om Times Magazine is one of the leading online content providers of positivity, wellness, and personal empowerment. A philanthropic organization, their net proceeds are funneled to support worldwide charity initiatives via Humanity Healing International. Through their commitment to creating community and providing conscious content, they aspire to uplift humanity on a global scale. Om Times, co-creating a more conscious lifestyle.
More than 24 million Americans have an autoimmune disorder, and that number continues to grow. I'm Sharon Saylor, and I'm one of those 24 million. To put that number in perspective, cancer affects about 9 million and heart disease up to 22 million. That's why I've brought together top experts and those thriving regardless of their diagnosis to bring you the latest, most up-to-date information. Join me, Sharon Saylor, Friday night, 7 p.m. Eastern, for the Autoimmune Hour on Life Interrupted Radio to find out how to live your life uninterrupted.
Are you done with the daily barrage of negativity? Ready for some positivity? Creations Magazine has been inspiring the soul for over 30 years. delivering thought-provoking and solution-driven articles, essays, and poetry that inspire you to enjoy a vibrant life. Holistic health, personal and spiritual growth, relationships, the environment, and so much more. Read us online or order a subscription, creationsmagazine.com.
911, what is your emergency?
My kid shot himself.
All right, where's the wounds?
911, what's your emergency?
Help, my son shot his brother. 911, what is your emergency?
Okay. 911, please state your emergency.
Every day, 8 kids and teens are unintentionally killed or injured by loaded and unlocked guns.
It wasn't locked.
Learn how to make your home safer at endfamilyfire.org. Brought to you by the Ad Council and End Family Fire.
Hi, this is Steve Behrman. We're back with Dr. Larry Dossey. We're actually talking about the one mind. We're also talking about the healing power of prayer. Now, I remember a number of studies that actually were kind of jaw-dropping about how intercessionary prayer influences. And I remember coming to the conclusion, which is really what upset the actual religious people interfering with their brand, even if religion doesn't work, prayer does. What were some of the experiments that were done that you use as evidence in your book?
Well, they involve people. Some of the earliest experiments did involve people who were in coronary care units, either recovering from a heart attack or having undergone coronary artery bypass surgery, and so on. These studies showed mixed results. The famous Harvard study, which is widely viewed as a put-down of this whole area, happened to be one of the poorest design studies. But there are, out of several hundred studies out there in the general field, about a third of them do involve human beings. And the overall meta-analysis of this area shows that the statistics are highly in favor of a definite effect from prayer. There's one thing about these studies that they don't include, however, and that's cases of spontaneous healing, where people just get well on their own after praying for themselves or some individual saying prayers over them. These studies never get mentioned in these double-blind control studies. And they're part of the record, however. I have begun to collect some of the spontaneous healing stories, and they just knock your socks off. The religious word for these is miracle, and I've begun to talk about these spontaneous healings at medical schools around the country, and the response has been entirely positive about these studies.
You know, it's really interesting that the pushback you got was from the religious people, and you know, the fact that the medical establishment is beginning to, over the past 30 years or more since you wrote this book, is beginning to encompass these healing modalities. I think that we tend to forget that over this very short amount of time, there's been a reinfusion of that spiritual dimension into medicine, and as you had reported, you know, here are doctors who may not have a forum for actually standing up and saying, "This is what happened," but nonetheless, when they do, they see a lot of nodding heads in the audience. So, say a little bit more about the impact that that's had on medicine over the past generation.
Well, the impact has gone beyond simple studies looking at intercessory prayer, people praying for others at a distance. Those studies are on the books. There are quite a number of them. But I want to say that the effect of spiritual practice goes beyond the effects of prayer on people's health. Prayer may not be involved in some of the data. For example, we know through thousands of studies now that people who follow some sort of spiritual path in their life, and I have to add that it doesn't seem to matter which one they pick, but if they pick a spiritual path and they stick with it, they live on average of 7 to 13 years longer than people who do not follow such a religious path. This is astonishing. This is data that is largely unquestioned, this benefit of a spiritual practice in somebody's life. There's not a whole lot that we doctors can recommend to people that's going to, on average, add 7 to 13 years more to their life. But adherence to a spiritual practice does this. Now, skeptics have said that, well, you know, that has nothing to do with spirituality. These people just have better health habits. They may smoke less and drink less and follow a good diet. And all those things certainly figure in. But the willingness to adhere to those good health practices often stems from people's commitment to a spiritual path. So this is one reason why the medical schools have largely come on board exploring the connection between spirituality, spiritual practice, and health and longevity. You know, it really takes it takes a diehard skeptic these days to say that spirituality just makes no difference in people's lives. The data shows exactly the opposite. One of the things that fascinates me is that one thing we've touched on is the influence of healing intentions, not just on other people, which you could say is just attributable to the placebo response, but when, you know, bacteria grow quicker and more avidly after being prayed for, or if fungi growing on petri dishes in laboratories grow more aggressively, or germination of seeds increases, and this sort of thing, you can't ascribe that to the placebo response. As far as we know, bacteria and fungi and plants don't have they don't think positively, so you can't ascribe these increases in healthiness and growth to the placebo response. Putting it all together, Steve, there's just an incredible theoretical and experimental body of knowledge that says we ignore these spiritual issues to our own detriment. And I think there's just an awakening now in the part of hardcore physicalists who used to dominate medicine that we're not justified any longer in ignoring these issues.
And, you know, it's very interesting that here we are. We're in a way, as Paul Ray pointed out in his work on the cultural creatives, we really have three competing paradigms. We have the old school, traditional religion, that excludes, the creationist kind of approach. We have the scientific materialist approach that doesn't really have the capacity at this time to even explore the kinds of things that you're talking about. And if you're talking about fundamentalist atheists, they can't really handle that. And then there's this emerging paradigm that Paul Ray called the cultural creatives,
right,
that are really willing to address these relationships. So we have the shifting of the ages, and now that's going to bring us to the one mind concept, because obviously if our thoughts and prayers and intentions are having that kind of impact on physical particles somewhere at a remote, instantly and remotely, violating even the speed of light, so to speak, your idea of this one mind seems to be a really good organizing principle for this new paradigm. So let's unwrap that a little bit. Tell us more about how the one mind seems to encompass these unexplained healings, so to speak.
Well, the basic idea is that intentions are not limited to the person who's having them. That is what we mean by non-local extensions of consciousness, the ability of our thoughts to make a difference at a distance and even outside the present. I think that it is beginning to sink into people who are sensitive about environmental issues that this idea of the one mind and are concerned about other species and environmental issues in general, is necessary if we're going to meet the challenges that we are meeting as a species on this planet. A lot of people who have begun to talk about the connection between this one mind form of looking at consciousness and our ability to survive. And if I had to point to one thing that is most crucial about this, it would not be that we have a nifty new way to help people get over any particular illness, but it may have to do with their survival as a species on this planet. As Alice Walker, the great novelist, said, anything we love can be saved. I think that pretty much encapsulates where we are at as a species. If we had this idea that we're connected via consciousness with other sentient creatures on the earth, then they would be worth saving. There would be a sacredness to our presence on this earth that extends beyond our concern for ourselves. I think this would constitute a huge boost for environmental concerns and possibly for our own salvation as a species. W.H. Auden, the great poet, said in the 1930s, as if he were looking into the present, he said, we must love one another or die. I think that these comments are right on. And I think one way of making this leap into concern for other species is to realize that we're connected to them by consciousness. We're not an isolated species that is the reserve of consciousness and mind. It extends to all of creation. I think unless we come to this realization in some deep way, we're going to have a very difficult, if not impossible, challenge in meeting the challenges that we're confronted with today.
You know, even this is all occurring on a fractal level. As medical scientists now coming to understand, there is this microbiome that transcends our physical bodies, that lives in us and lives outside of us, and that this web of life is partly what, this is what keeps us nourished, physically nourished, and that the microbiome inside and outside in our soil is essential, that even physically these particles are all interrelated with one another. And when we see ourselves as individual bodies or entities, we're really just seeing part of the picture. And so what you're saying is that in addition to the individual aspect of us, which has been celebrated in Western civilization in a way to the point of detriment, we are now having to recognize that this all-encompassing love is just is the one thing that holds everything together.
Well, I think that's exactly true. I think this insight, which you've just described, that we're part of everything, everything is part of us, could help us revise some of our guiding principles from some of the world's great religions. I would single out the Golden Rule, which there's a version in every major religion. The usual rendition is that we should do unto others as we would have them do unto us, which has always seemed really sort of a selfish interpretation. If we sense their connection with every other creature, we could revise or upgrade the Golden Rule to something like this. Be kind to others because in some sense they are you. Mm-hmm. I think this just sort of ups the ante about our responsibility to other sentient creatures on the earth and our regard for the environment that supports all of us.
You know, that's exactly right. And we can see that there's a certain awareness that people have. And, you know, some people were born with it. Some people got it through like the experiences that you encountered where you're having these totally inexplicable dreams that would indicate that you're getting information from somewhere else. And it just seems that there's a certain threshold of awareness that's required in order to encompass this this paradigm. we're going to take a short break in a little bit, and we'll talk more about that. But in the time we have left right now, what is that? How are you noticing the that mainstream society is coming to a greater awareness about this interconnection?
Well, I think there are a lot of social indicators that that the one mind exists. You know, I think they're all over the place. Consider the love of a mother for her infant, her newborn. If you pick this apart, there isn't any felt division between a mother and her infant. It's as if there are two people combined into one. They're a single entity, and good parenting and good mothering just assumes that that's the case. I think the attention of people to their heritage and the genetic histories that people can order these days over the internet, looking at their legacies on Earth, I think this is an indicator that we really have a deepening sense of our ancestors, and we want to know more about where we came from. I think that this fascination with crowdfunding also is an indication that we can help one another, that we're not totally separate, and that we can make a difference in people's lives via the internet. And the whole connection now that's global through internet connectivity, I think, is a factor that is increasing our willingness to go in the one mind direction. I want to say that the one mind, however, would exist even if there were not any cell phones in existence. I'm not talking about the digital kind of connectivity that unites us, but something really deeper at a fundamental level of consciousness that predates 20 and 21st century inventions. But even having said that, I think that all of these other influences are coming together to remind us that we withdraw from our connectivity at our great peril. And so there's every reason to foster these ideas that I've been presenting about the ability of consciousness to reach out beyond your individual brain and body to make a difference in the world.
Wow. Well, we're going to take a very short break. We'll be back with Dr. Larry Dosti and talking more about the one mind and, of course, the one heart that we share. This is Steve Behrman on WikiPolitics.
Free your mind with Om Times Radio, IOM FM.
Ascending Hearts is no ordinary dating site, but a spiritual dating site with a purpose, to link you with your soulmate. We engineer the serendipity so you can trust that you will attune with someone that has the same matching vibration as you. Ascending Hearts, the conscious dating site for the spiritually aware. Try Ascending Hearts for free, ascendinghearts.com.
Hello, I'm Lisa Berry. Join me every Monday at 1 p.m. Eastern Time for Light on Living, a chance to see new, hear different, and feel more as I shine the spotlight on all the ways to lighten the load of life's challenges. Light on Living is your link to that new way you're looking for, that new understanding that will enhance your life, and that positive connection that will support your growth. So join me, and you'll gain insight and start to see things in a new way that motivates you.
The Shift Network. Presenting transformative programs and events to help you awaken to your full potential so that together we can build the more beautiful world our hearts know is possible. Our classes support you in finding and cultivating your gifts and in bringing those gifts to the world to create tangible change and connect us as global citizens. Go to theshiftnetwork.com or follow the link on the WikiPolitiki sponsors page.
Imagine being fired because of who you love. Imagine being denied medical treatment because of who you marry. Imagine being evicted because of who you are. Millions of Americans don't have to imagine this. They have to live it. Because in 31 states, it's legal to discriminate against LGBT people. Get the facts at beyondido.org. Brought to you by the Gill Foundation and the Ad Council.
Okay, this is Steve Berman. We're back with Dr. Larry Dossey. We're talking about the One Mind. How did this One Mind book come about? How did that? How were you able to weave all of the understandings that you have into that? How did that develop?
Well, I had written several books before, sort of poking around at the edges of this idea about collective consciousness, and I came across some studies that had been done in animals, which told me that, look, you need to take this further and try to put some more flesh on these bones. And one of the discoveries that made me go in the direction was a series of experiments that may have been discussed on your show already. They came from a sociologist in New York City, William Bingston, who has written a book called The Energy Cure. And Bill did a series of experiments which I thought just took this so much further than I had in my writing. What he did, Steve, was to take mice and transplant mammary cancer into them, and this is the same as breast cancer in women. And this is a terrible thing to do to mice, I have to say, because after 30 days, they're all dead. They don't spontaneously get over this transplanted cancer. But he taught college students to use a technique to cure them, just using their consciousness, their intentions. And as college students did this, and some of these kids were so cynical, they didn't believe it would work, but so long as they did the technique, about 90% of the mice with this transplanted cancer got well. The cancer went entirely away. And so that was not the end of the spectacular nature of this experiment. When he went back and he tried to re-implant cancer, breast cancer, in the healed mice, he couldn't do it. The cancer would not take, which said that these mice had somehow become immune to breast cancer through this healing effort by the kids. So this suggests that we are in the process of looking at what went on in these mice. What was it that made them immune to breast cancer? There are pharmaceutical companies now who are intensely working on developing a vaccine against breast cancer, which would save millions of women from this lethal disease. So I began to really have a new appreciation of the social magnitude of what we're talking about here, about the healing effects of intentions and so on. So I was just stimulated to think more deeply about the social implications of the One Mind and the ability of consciousness to make a difference in the biological processes that often kill human beings. So that was one of the main sources of impetus for taking this idea farther in the book, The One Mind.
When was that experiment done with the mice? It's amazing that I've never heard of it.
You can look it up on the internet and find out the fine points about this and how it works. Bill's last name is Bengston. If you Google Bill Bingston, you'll come up with this body of information. I think it's important for listeners to know that there have been 16 of these separate experiments now that have been done in academic institutions all over the United States, which, again, people can find out about at the website. But, you know, when we talk about the healing effects of human intentions, we're not talking about just curing the common cold or helping people get over the flu. We're talking about some of the major killers in human history here when we talk about the physical implications of this. So I wanted to bring this data, this healing information, these experiments up to date. So that was one of the inspirations for doing this book on the One Mind.
You know, that is really I mean, first of all, I wonder how it would work on humans, because mice don't know that it can't work. They're not susceptible to the placebo. They're also not susceptible to the nocebo, you know, to the to the negative inductions that take place. Say more about that, because I think that you've also written about the shadow side of Crick.
Well, when I give talks to the public and even in medical schools about these ideas, somebody in the audience always asks, well, if there are positive effects of our intentions, what about negative effects? Could we inhibit healing in other people and other organisms and so on? This became such an issue in this discussion that I did write a book about this. It's called Be Careful What You Pray For. And it looks at the negative side of our thoughts and our intentions, and they are very real. Actually, there are many experiments now that show that people can harm other living things with their thoughts. These studies aren't done in people because that would be illegal. If they work, you could go to jail for harming people with one of these experiments. So they're done on other organisms, like inhibiting the growth rate of bacteria, inhibiting the growth rate of plants and seedlings and germinating seeds and that sort of thing. I think that there is a corollary in human culture that we've referred to in many cultures as hexes and curses and that sort of thing. You know, ours is one of the only cultures in the world that doesn't talk about these things openly. But there's a side of our religions that do honor the fact that the negative side is real. For example, there's a phrase in the Lord's Prayer that says, deliver us from evil. And I thought that this was a tacit acknowledgement that, you know, evil is out there. Hexes and curses and spells are part of it. So I think that there's definitely that side of it. Having said that, I don't think that we ought to lie awake at night fearing being blindsided by people's negative thoughts. I suspect that we've developed something sort of like a spiritual immune system that protects us from people's negative intentions and thoughts. Lord knows I've invoked that a lot, having had a lot of criticism. So I think that although there is the negative side, I think that we're right to think that the light usually drives out the shadows and the darkness. So I like to think on the bright positive side of this aspect of the one mind and not the negative.
Well, and it's interesting that so many people who delved into this, they really understand that one mind is actually a coherent and positive force, so that these deviations, toxins or we call them in politics, we call them sociopathogens. That those are simply the absence of this oneness, the absence of this love and so on. And I think that we're at the point where we are now as a civilization. I think the people who are listening to this show, most people I know, are looking for ways to actually practically adopt and use this perennial wisdom and knowledge. So in the remaining time, given that there is this one mind, and given that there, if we read the news and look at all of the afflictions, we go, really? How do we actually begin to bring this into our lives and world in a individual, a familial, and a larger scale collective way?
I'm glad you brought this up, because I think it's easier than we think. I mean, people hearing us talk about this may think that this is so exotic and so foreign that they could never develop an awareness of this one mind. I think that the main problem people run into is trying too hard. They think this is beyond their reach. It's too difficult. So, you know, to heck with it. I believe it's exactly the opposite. I think that there are so many ways that the one mind awareness can impinge on us in our daily lives that it's almost ridiculously easy to cultivate this. One way that my wife, Barbara, and I have used over many, many years is through exposure to nature. We are avid backpackers, and for 3 decades, we have managed to structure our life in order every August to go up into wilderness, high country, somewhere in the Rocky Mountains between Mexico and Canada, and just be. We camp out and hike and fly fish and do hobbies, write new chapters in books at 12,000 feet. You know, you can get your consciousness tremendously modified by doing something like that. Exposure to nature might be close to the top of my list on how to open up to this awareness. There are other things people can do. They have in common turning off the rational mind and letting the awareness that is everybody's ability at the level of the unconscious, letting that awareness bubble up into our conscious awareness. Exposure to great art, visiting museums, listening to exalted music is another way of turning off the rational mind. I want to add, however, that another option is turning on the rational mind. The way we do that, and what has been of enormous assistance to me, is just looking at the evidence that's on the record that the one mind is a necessary conclusion in order to explain the outcomes of certain experiments. We've touched on those experiments, healing at a distance that transforms not just distant people who are ill, but also other forms of life as well. We have our choice. We can either toss out this data and say that it's silly and it's wrong, or we can try to imagine what form of consciousness might exist in order to permit those outcomes. That's been my approach, and that's the approach that has shifted the consciousness of so many of our medical schools in this direction. But when it's all said and done, I think we don't have to do anything purposefully to turn on this awareness of the one mind. I think it just happens in people's lives. I call it the process of just spiritual growth and spiritual maturity that we often experience just through the process of opening up and growing older. I think it's part of our natural inheritance by virtue of becoming more mature and keeping an open mind as we grow older. You know, there.
I think probably everybody listening to this program can relate to everybody is growing older. It's really interesting how that's working. We're all kind of, as we are actually maturing in a way as a civilization, even though all of the contradictions are coming up. In the midst of all of this, what the Swami would call a situation, the situations we have out there.
I
like that word. It's so descriptive. What do you see as the most encouraging signs, the signs of the uprising, as you look out at how these things are unfolding?
Well, I think there's a growing sense of desperation, Steve. I mean, I hate to use that word. But I think it's becoming increasingly aware to most thinking, sensitive people that we're in trouble on this earth. We face challenges that we can't run away from, even though it's politically popular in our country now to divorce ourselves from some of these increasing problems having to do with overpopulation and poisoning of our atmosphere and water shortages and on and on. That only gets us so far. We will not be able to thrive and perhaps even survive on this planet unless we open up to a larger form of consciousness that makes it clear that other forms of life are sacred, that we're united and connected with them, and there's nothing we can do besides self-destruction that's going to alter that. It's incorporated in that great motto from the Whole Earth Catalog back in the 70s or late 60s. You can't put it together. It is together. I think we're growing into that realization, and I think it's our best hope for thriving and surviving. And I think this is becoming uppermost in the minds of an increasing number of people, probably 90-plus percent of the listeners to your show.
You know, I really appreciate that perspective, because it's kind of like, as you're suggesting, this oneness already exists. It can't not exist. And the only thing that's changing is our appreciation of it, our awareness of it, are beginning to see those connections that, you know, our so-called civilization has largely made invisible to us. And now, since we have the opportunities through the internet and through these other systems to see more clearly, and as you say, the rational mind works, because as you look at all of the overwhelming scientific evidence that we're connected, it's irrefutable. So I want to thank you, Larry Gillespie, for being our guest on WikiPolitiki. His book is called One Mind, How Our Individual Mind is Part of the Greater Consciousness and Why It Matters. It does matter a lot. Thank you, Larry, for being our guest. This is Steve Behrman, and this is WikiPolitiki. Thank you.